what I'm going to do for the next part of our seminar together. Take us through the process of looking at a man, John Moses, and his experience of having created a career with all of the best intentions and then seeing the career end summarily. And in midlife, having now to come face to face with a new life. We'll then talk about what John Moses could have done differently by taking you through the seven steps of the management development process, the business development process, that effectively every manager in this room must truly become intimately familiar with and utilize in order to transform your experience of being a manager. What I'm saying is that each and every single person in this room, no matter where you work, can do that. Now, what I'm also suggesting is you may come face to face as you begin to do that with a problem. And the problem is that you may begin to create friction between you and those for whom you work, in which case it's inevitable. But you have created an ethical path that effectively will bring you an ethical conclusion, which will in all transform your life and the next organization of which you become a part, or the organization of which you are a part. Because the logic of this, the logic of what I'm going to be teaching you, is absolutely undeniable, and it's universal. You could do this in South Africa, you could do this in the UK, you could do this in France, you could do this in Southeast Asia, you could do this in Australia, you can do this in any country, any place in the world, and you could do it in a high-tech business, a low-tech business, a no-tech business. You can do it in a miniature business. You can do it in a macro business. You can do it anywhere, because it is a universal process that has been practiced assiduously, flying in the face of everything that managers believe in and producing results that no manager can laugh at, scoff at, or deny, because they're truly transformative. There is no doubt about it. American management is dying. It's not a slow death. It's a fast death, and very, very painful. It's a death which could have been predicted and probably avoided if anyone was looking, but no one was. Or if they were, they didn't care. Or if they cared, which I seriously doubt, they thought it was a passing phenomenon, a temporal economic blip or something to do with automation, the flattening of the corporation, re-engineering, right-sizing, or some such transition, evolution, natural process. But it wasn't these things, and it isn't these things. No, there's something much deeper going on here, much more pervasive, much more dangerous, much more alarming. And that is that we are suffering from a fundamental misunderstanding about what management is. A deep-seated mistake made at the outset of the Industrial Revolution. A mistake which has run its course, cost us untold billions of American capital, in fact, worldwide capital, and in the course of time destroyed the lives of millions upon untold millions of those who were taught to be managers and who proceeded to be managers, and who took solace in the extraordinary business successes which they presumed to be to their credit, but which, of course, had nothing or very little to do with them. Their successes then gave birth to beliefs about management, which were all as false as the successes they presumed to be theirs, which beliefs in turn became courses of study, which further added credibility to the beliefs upon which those courses were founded, which further entrenched the beliefs, which further enhanced the aura of the successes, which were then utilized as exemplars for the now towering institution of management babble, thought to be by the pundits of American management and eventually the world as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar. And of course, as we all know today, it isn't. As proof positive for anyone who doubts this thesis of mine, witness the dead and dying managers all around us. As we've already said, millions upon millions upon millions of them are leaving American corporations, which in fact were founded upon the whole idea of continuous employment, careers for life, a job for life. You'll be with AT&T forever, because of course AT&T will be forever. Won't it? This meeting is an attempt to rectify this condition. It's also a clarion call to all of those of us who think of ourselves as managers in large organizations and small, that the grim management reaper has not passed us by forever, but is simply clicking them off in a random harvest, which will ultimately take its inevitable toll. Die on the job or off, but die you will. For many millions of managers will continue to pay the price of this huge lack of understanding, which management is and what management isn't, and never has been, despite all the academic claptrap to the contrary. Management is an inside job first, and only long after that, a job of work. And that even then, as one turns to work, management has nothing to do with managing people. The clear fact is that people can't be managed. We've already learned that. All management to this day has attempted to do the impossible. American management, despite all the rhetoric concerning empowerment and win-win, has not been about management at all, but about manipulation and coercion. And of course, while people can't be managed, they certainly can be manipulated and coerced. Money will do it. Power will do it. Narcissism will do it. Fear will do it. Punishment will do it. But that is not the management of the kind I wish to speak of here. That's management as it has been done for centuries, and as it is still being done today throughout the world. All I'm going to attempt to do here is to provide you with a rational, heartfelt, stunningly rewarding alternative to management as you and I both know it. It will speak for itself. Or if it doesn't, you'll go the way you were going when you first came to this meeting. But if it does, as I hope it will, as I sincerely trust it will, when we're done, and if the path I've outlined here makes cosmic sense to you, your life will take an entirely new path from the one you're currently on. Whether you stay on that path or not is, of course, up to you. All I can promise here is that we'll get started together. You have my commitment to that. Let me tell you a story about John Moses. John Moses went to work one day to discover he didn't have a job. It wasn't that the job went away. It was that his employer took it away from him. The surprise to John Moses was that he was damn good at his job. He'd been doing it for 14 years. The company had grown substantially during his watch. His people thought nothing but the best of him. His employer was a prince of a guy who would always seem to care about John Moses, about the job he was doing, about the contributions he had made to the company's growth. And now, suddenly, without any warning, the job he had so committed himself to was gone. John Moses was stunned at first, then guilty for having let his family down, then ashamed to be out in the street after more than 22 years of productive corporate work, then angry. The anger didn't come quickly for John Moses. He was a good corporate boy. He'd learned to push the anger down early in his career. He'd learned that anger only got in the way of results, got in the way of relationships, got in the way of his career. And above all, he had learned early on in his corporate acculturation process, don't mess with your career. Your career is who you are. Your career is all you've got. Your career is the path to financial, psychological, and cultural security. Your career defines your role in society. Your career marks you as a man or a boy. Your career is all. Above all, do not mess with your career. His parents had told him that, especially his father. His father told him that explicitly, gave him dour warnings that if he didn't hunker down and do something with his life would turn into shit in short order. His first employer told him that. Not as explicitly as his father, of course. Employers, he learned, were never as explicit about anything as his father was. No, on the job, things were implied. His first employer was not his first career move. John Moses' first employer got him through school. He was reminded of that every day. Moses, his first employer, would say, you're a lucky boy. Lucky to have a job. Lucky to be working for me. Lucky to be alive. Don't screw it up. His first employer, a man named Cody, taught John Moses, whether he was interested or not, everything he would need to know to get along in his life. The days at work were about working as hard as John Moses could while listening to his employer, Cody, rail about the injustices of life, the price a man had to pay to get along, the stuff a man would have to eat to put food on the table, and the justice of all that. There are people who work for other people, his employer would say, and there are people for whom other people work. Choose the first, John Moses. You don't have the guts to choose the second. His employer was emphatic about that, emphatic that John Moses had better choose a career and fast, because without one, he'd be dog meat. It was interesting to John Moses as he thought about his first employer that John Moses had never once thought to ask him a question, such as, why did he think John Moses didn't have the guts to become an employer? Such as, why did he feel so certain that if John Moses didn't pick a career and fast, he would end up as dog meat? As he thought back to his first job, John Moses had to laugh. He didn't realize until today that his first employer was a comedian. He didn't find anything funny about it then. Then it was deadly serious. Then it was working and hoping that you didn't lose your job so that you could get through school and studying at school stuff you weren't interested in because you had to get through school and with the grades so as to begin your career or everything, absolutely everything, would come crashing down. Everybody told him that. Everybody taught him that. Everybody spoke of nothing else at school, at home, at work. All the time, that message was clear. And of course, it was a different day. This wasn't today. This was 22 years ago. This was when careers meant something different. Only 22 years ago. Can you imagine that? The job, the school, the whole process, including his father, were one weave of cloth coming together, spreading out in John Moses' mind as the fabric of his life, of his future, of his past. His first employer was a comedian. John Moses was now certain of that. But why, if he was a comedian, was he so deadly earnest about his joke? His one big joke was that John Moses was completely dependent upon him for the gift of life. That without him, his employer, John Moses would have to find another job, or even two, and that for John Moses to have to find another job while going to school full-time, while trying to balance his very unbalanced life, would create stress and strain which John Moses wasn't about to handle. And he was right. John Moses hung onto that job with his very breath. The thought of having to deal with looking for a new job, dealing with a new employer, was beyond him. Better the stress he knew than the stress he could only imagine. Better to stuff his feelings than to express them. Better to get on with his life than deal with the life he had. So his first employer was right all along. He was to prove to be the most important teacher John Moses ever had. Unfortunately, he taught him the wrong lesson, but he was very good at it. Without a doubt, John Moses knew today that his first employer, Cody, was very adept at teaching John Moses the lessons Cody thought John Moses had to learn. Yes, his first employer was a comedian, but there was a certain ugliness about his humor. That's why John Moses didn't think it was funny then. His life was at stake. At least he thought it was. And wasn't that also the lesson his first employer was teaching him, reinforcing for him, playing deep down the center of his soul? Your life is at stake. Don't forget it, boy. It doesn't get any better than this. Stuff it, eat it, and do what you're asked. The rewards will be great. The rewards will be a certain path, a certain life, a dependable, comfortable way, a career. Your reward will be you won't have to suffer any unnecessary pain. Such as the pain of having to find another job. Such as the pain of worrying about whether you will find another job. Such as the pain of having to learn something new, deal with someone else's style, satisfy someone else's needs, someone else's demands, someone else's commands. So it was with a great sense of relief and dread that John Moses graduated from college, got married, and got his first real job, his first step on what was to prove to be an exemplary career ladder. Until today, that is. Today, there was no career. Today, the whole thing had come crashing down. Just as his first employer had so prophetically warned him if he failed to do his job. But John Moses had done his job, and it had happened anyway, despite the lessons he'd learned, despite everything he had done throughout his career, throughout his lifetime, to nurture his status within the community, the corporate community, the family community, the social community, within which he had become such a respected and exemplary member, despite his willingness to stuff it, it had happened anyway. His first step on the corporate ladder was not accomplished with a flourish. Nothing John Moses had ever done in his life had been that. No, his first step had been a quiet, unassuming, thoughtful, and serious one. He did what was asked of him. He pushed the limits of his own life inside to accomplish what was asked of him on the outside. He gave up his time. He studied into the night. He worked long hours every day. He moved with his now growing family three times during that first step. Once across country, once to the Midwest, once back to where he started out. He became a reliable resource. He became someone who could be depended upon. He was promoted three times, received more perks, benefits, salary, bonuses, moved up on the corporate ladder, and worked ever harder in the process. His life was fast becoming a cliche. But John Moses didn't know that. Not then. Not until much, much later. Deep down inside, there resided an earnestness which he couldn't account for. Deep down inside, he truly wanted to be needed, to be necessary, to play a serious part in the life around him. Deep down inside, he thought he was doing exactly the right thing. Not as well as it could have been done, of course. Certainly he knew that he was not one of the bright stars of his company's constellation. He was a plotter. But he was as steady as anyone he knew. He got the job done. The company grew. His people respected him. He felt a certain sense of growing dignity. He was becoming mature. He was, even at home, where his mother and father still lived, his father retired, his mother wistful as always, respected. His father didn't carpet him anymore. For after all, hadn't John Moses done exactly what he had said? They talked about the company, about John Moses' work, about the fortunes of the American economy, and about all manner and forms of things John Moses was becoming very adept at discussing. He learned how to do that at work. He learned how to cover the bases of good corporate conversation at work, among his peers, and at home, with his wife, and at the organizations, Kiwanis, Rotary, Chamber of Commerce, and the rest, where he played out his dutiful social responsibilities as well as the rest of them. There was even a sense of purpose in John Moses. He felt he was doing something meaningful. He identified with the company of which he was a small cog, admittedly, but a necessary cog in the wheel of progress, in the wheel of growth. His company was contributing something important to society. That was how it was talked about when the guys at work got serious. That was the kind of language they used, contributing something important to society. Of course, there was another conversation going on at work. He called it the underground conversation. The conversation about what happened to Jack, what happened to Alice, what happened to Fernando. But these conversations, John Moses knew, were tacitly unprofessional, were somehow unclean, were bordering on rebellious. What happened to Jack, Alice, and Fernando was off the point by a wide margin. What happened to them could happen to anyone who didn't cut it. That was justice. That was the free enterprise system. That was to be understood by anyone who truly understood the value of the career process. Blow it and you're out. John Moses wasn't about to blow it. He knew his role and played it. Then came the offer. An offer from another company. They'd been watching John Moses. They knew the job he was doing, could do, and that he wasn't going to get anywhere where he was. His present employer didn't appreciate him the way this new company did. His present employer, therefore, wasn't compensating him as well as he deserved. He was a player, the new company said, a true player in his present employer's operation, and true players deserve to be compensated highly for the contribution they make. This new company was prepared to compensate John Moses highly for the contribution they knew he would and could make to their rapidly expanding, exciting, dominating market position. John Moses had never been spoken to like that before. It was a painful decision to make. He had devoted 8 years of his life to his first career company. He was solidly entrenched. He was liked. He knew his job and could depend upon doing it well. There were few painful spots in his career to date other than the normal ones. The pain of long hours, the pain of not being absolutely certain you could get the project in on schedule, the painful uncertainty about what was going on in the boardroom, what decisions top management was making, which could certainly cause the balance of your fate to become unbalanced in a hurry. But he had learned how to deal with all of these pains of a free market economy. Somehow he knew and respected the rules of that game, and because he paid dutiful respect every day on the job and at home after work and on weekends when he prepared for the next week's work, he not only survived, but managed to grasp a substantial level of security out of all this. And now the unthinkable had happened. Now somebody from the outside had come into his life with an offer. Wasn't this his reward after having done such a credible job? To be noticed, to be appreciated, to be solicited, to be given the opportunity to judge the merit of the offer, the company, the people themselves who were making the offer? Wasn't this, after all, the justice he was so richly deserving? John Moses had a decision to make. But this was the kind of decision he was not accustomed to making. This was the kind of decision the stars made, seemingly easily because they were so incredibly effective, so colorful, so verbal, so hot. Yes, that's what it was. John Moses had never in all his life been thought of or thought of himself as hot. He wasn't hot. He was steady. But for the first time in his life, to be regarded as hot was a rush. It was almost sexual in its way. He could choose to say yes or no. He was in control of the outcome in a way he had never experienced in his entire life before. In control of the outcome. It was almost more than he could bear, but he was stuck in it. He was truly, thoroughly enraptured by it. His days during that period of seduction were the most exciting days of his entire life. Of course, he accepted their offer. How could he not? Almost twice the money, a position of stature in the new company he never would have reached, he was certain, in the old company. Or if he had, it would have taken him forever, given his current pace. And after all, wasn't it the old company's fault for not fairly compensating him for the contribution he'd made to its success, for not appreciating him as much as they should have for the time and effort and commitment made daily on its behalf? The new offer was simply freeing John Moses to feel things he had stuffed before. In fact, the new employer was justifying those feelings. It was not of John Moses' doing. He was still the faithful corporate citizen he had always been. He wasn't, of course, feeling any rage at his previous employer's lack of appreciation. They had, after all, done their part. They'd given him what he had expected, what he thought was fair, what he had come to regard as reasonable. He knew he wasn't a star then, nor even now with his new exalted position. No, he wasn't a star. He was simply being fairly compensated now for the work he had so steadfastly done on behalf of his previous employer, on behalf of his career, up till this point in time. This was a natural step in the process. He knew it. This was what it was all about. Everything was right in the world, just as his father had said. Well, the new job was anything but easy. In fact, the rush he experienced at being seduced very quickly gave way to the helplessness of experience having given up his security, having given up his control. During all of the time with his previous employer, he realized now there had been this sense of being in control. He knew what was expected of him, and he discovered he could do it. That discovery became his security blanket. Somehow, despite how little he really knew about what was really going on in the company, about what was really going on in the lives of his peers, about what was really going on in the heads of the people who reported to him, about what was really going on in the marketplace and the economy and in the government and all of those things he and his peers and his family took to be so self-evident on the surface, did everyone he knew as little as he how the business worked, his job worked, his life worked? Yet despite that, despite how little he really knew, how much a mystery his life was to him, somehow he managed to get the job done, and he took solace in that. He truly felt the stability he was looking for had been found. If everything worked out as it seemed to be working out, his old job was the dream he had been looking for. But then he had been seduced. And wasn't this the second seduction after all? Wasn't this new position the second seduction? Or maybe even one of many he'd never recognized as a seduction before? Hadn't he been seducing himself all along? Hadn't he wanted to believe in something which believed in him? The honeymoon didn't last long. The new employer was not the old employer. The new employer was on a fast track. At least that's how it was understood in the new employer's culture. Everyone referred to the job as a fast track job. There was a certain amount of arrogance in it, in the saying of it, in the expression and experience of it, in the living of it, John Moses thought to himself early on in the game, a certain stardom that was conferred upon everyone in the company by simply being there. Suddenly, John Moses was thrust into the position of being a star in a constellation that was expanding exponentially in every direction. Nothing stayed as it was for long. People were moved, it seemed, indiscriminately. Projects begun hastily, only to die an early, sometimes violent death. The company was in a hurry, that was for sure, because everyone knew in the company that life in the fast track was a game in which no one could afford to be caught standing still. Move, move, move was the energy of the fast track. John Moses had never experienced anything like it before. Now he was on the fast track, thrust into a stardom which he had never experienced before, pushing in all directions at once like the stars he knew from the outside did at the old company, but in a vortex which had not included him. He had always been the voice of reason, and at the old company, reason had always prevailed. Certainly the markets were different there, the products more mature. But still, at the old employers, he had relished the quiet sanctity of space that he could surround himself with, that was very difficult, if not impossible, for those on the outside to penetrate if he was determined to sustain that space, that distance, which of course he was. The space, the distance, was his control, his buffer. But here, at the new employers, there was no space. There was a continuous demand, the continuous excitement, the continuous intoxication of move, move, move. Get there fast, get there before anyone else does, or we're all lost. And since he'd given up the security of his past for the seduction of the present, there was nothing he could do about it. He was caught, at least that's how it seemed to him at the beginning. He was caught, and the atmosphere was suffocating. He could see no reasonable way out. He'd moved his family at great expense, had settled into a new community, had committed himself and his future, his career, inexorably to the new employer's future. His fate was sealed. For a time, everything was like a whirlwind. He couldn't see anything in any direction. Orders, requests, commands, needs came from everywhere he looked. He tried to discipline himself not to look, but it wasn't a strategy, just a reaction. If I don't see them, they won't see me. But of course they did. He was one of the high-priced newcomers, brought in to achieve a result that the new employer coveted, but which once it possessed, it immediately turned it to its own advantage. The new employer knew nothing of reason, knew nothing of method, knew nothing of time. Time was a word in the new employer's lexicon, which was defined as now, now, now. As one senior management put it, we're going 70 miles an hour on the freeway, we got a flat tire, but we can't stop to fix it. Move, move, move. And gradually John Moses learned to move. He learned to do the job in the new way that was expected of him. It seemed that his entire being was being wrenched from its sockets, but wrench it he did, move he did, respond he did. In other words, he made do. He learned from his new employer how to call the unreasonable reason, how to call the insane logic, how to call the unimaginable imaginable, how to call the unmanageable manageable, how to do the impossible, not because it was really possible, but because no one dared to call it the impossible in the new employer's culture. To do so would be a violation of the code, the new employer's code. The new employer's code was, this is the truth. There is no other truth. This is the truth for as long as it remains the truth, and when it no longer is the truth, it is a lie. Then the new truth is the only truth. Of course, this was never said explicitly. It was implied. No one would dare to say such a thing explicitly. And so, immersed as he was in this new corporate culture, John Moses made a commitment one night, deep in depression, in overwhelm, at the condition he found himself in, to survive at all cost. Survive at all cost, John Moses said to himself. Amen. That was a long time ago. Very little changed in the interim, except that the culture of the new employers shifted radically over that time from one harangue to another, even though move, move, move was the common theme. First it was move there, then it was move over there, then it was move over there. But that's how things are in the fast track, everyone in the new employers knew. In fact, the whole industry knew it, of which they were a part. That's how it is on a fast track. Chaos is inevitable. Nurture chaos. Nurture it. Nurture it. It's all you got. All the while, John Moses was using up his time, moving up his career. And as quickly as he was forced to move in the new employer's culture, now, 14 years after his seduction, 22 years into his career path, the slower he moved in the way of his life. His life became a seascape of molasses, a monotony of passivity, a resting place from work. I go home to rest so I can go back to work. I go home to stop, so I have something left to start with in the morning. If I don't stop, was the fragile awakening, I won't be able to start, and if I am unable to start, I am lost.
His life became a series of zones, the zone where he arrived at work, the zone he would desperately seek out in face of complication at work, the zone he would discover in defense of his sanity when confronted by his people at work, different zones for different people, the zone he would seek out when he called into management meetings with his manager, with the top management, or when he called such meetings. This is your job, John Moses. All the time, the ache would be increasing in intensity, a sullen underground throb in his head, in his gut, in his chest, at times, behind his eyes, aching to define the question, the words. But this part was by long practice, inarticulate, dumb, slow, not yet truly born. The burning up was a sensation all its own. At such times, he would feel a rush of intolerable rage overcome his entire body. At such times, he lost it, completely lost it. He wasn't certain that anyone noticed, but he knew. It was like a wild animal, burning with rage, completely uncontrollable, seething in its intensity, its need to run, to stretch its muscles, to do damage. Fortunately, John Moses had developed such a high level of control through years of practice that when the animal would rise up within him, he would know enough to leave, to take a walk, or to immerse himself in the job in front of him to match the intensity of the animal with an equally intense focus on work, to close his door until everything was put back into place. And then suddenly, without any warning, came the day when he was told the bad news. John Moses, we have to let you go because of blah, 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 blah. He couldn't even hear it after the first four words. His heart hurt. It actually hurt. He felt the pain as a sharp stab to his chest, to his sensibility, to his heart, to his inner core. It closed his throat. He hadn't even asked a question. He didn't ask why. He didn't ask what happened. He didn't ask, what about me? The fact is, he was so dazed, he didn't even think of those things. What he thought was nothing. Blank. Zero. Blah, blah, blah. He just felt exhausted. Completely empty. He couldn't comprehend what was happening to him. And the fact was that all he really wanted to do now was to go to sleep. Now, I know this experience is not an experience anyone here has had. And I know the experience of John Moses going through his corporate life being the good boy and acceding to the wishes of the powers that be without us are nothing that anyone here has done. And I'm certain none of your parents have created that kind of an impact on you as you were growing up at home. I'm certain that everything you wish to do and everything you wish to become was honored and nurtured and supported. I'm sure there were no, and if you don't, and if you do, and you should, I'm sure there was none of that, that actually you grew in a flowered existence in which personal freedom was relished and respected and dignified. And I'm sure when you were lying in bed dreaming, your mother didn't come by and said, what are you doing? And you said, thinking. And she said, thinking, get to work. I'm sure that didn't happen to anybody here. I'm sure thinking was the most respected thing in school. The school you went to, and I'm sure your kindergarten teacher taught you how to think, and your first grade teacher honored thinking, and your second, and your third, and your fourth, and your fifth, so by the time you got to sixth grade, you were all extraordinary students of how to think, that in fact you were trained in how to use the mind to explore. I'm sure that happened with each and every one of us, didn't it? And of course it didn't, and everybody here knows it didn't, and the product of that today is that we've learned what school is for. School is learned to memorize facts. And the better we memorize facts, the better student we become. And the better student we become, the more we can regurgitate facts. This is not the E-Myth manager's role in life. The role of the E-Myth manager in life is to transform the experience we have brought to this day into a living reality that's unlike anything you have ever done before. I'm going to describe the process by which one creates an E-Myth brand business. And understand that the manager is in fact accountable for the business, while the entrepreneur is accountable for the enterprise. But that the enterprise and the business and the practices which operate in order to produce the results in the world at the level of work, the tactical work of the business, must be seen as an integrated whole, because if it's not seen as an integrated whole, you will do what you've been taught to do all of your entire lives, which is to put everything into fragments as though they're disconnected. Every single one of us live in a specialized world. Specialization has driven all of us to put things into little boxes that are apart from other things in little boxes, which are apart from other things in little boxes, as though they were not a part of the same universe. The E-Myth manager cannot operate in a world of little boxes that are fragmented from other boxes, because boxes that are fragmented from other boxes create entropy, disease, disconnectivity, create objects out of people, create people as numbers, create words that we use in organizations today which should insult every living human being on earth and yet don't. We've accepted it. It's called human resources. You've become a human resource. The very description should fly in the face of your mortal being. To become a human resource, as opposed to a financial resource, as opposed to a mechanical resource, demeans the very meaning of human. It demeans the very meaning of being alive, of being awake, of being a contributor to the things that go on around us. We end up serving something which doesn't serve ourselves. The E-Myth manager is not a person who thrives, flourishes in an organization like that. So what I'm talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is a revolution. So what I'm asking that you do for the balance of today is to become revolutionaries. What I am going to suggest to you is this revolution is a simple, easily, methodically designed process through which any single person caught at the heart, the center of your existence, to wish to be reborn in the process of creating your work to match the spirit in your life, with a belief that, in fact, that's possible, then essentially it is impossible to stop this revolution. Because it's not something that extraordinary people need to do. Something that ordinary people can do. We have seen them do it over and over and over again in the process of producing extraordinary results for everybody around them. And it's the seven steps of a business development program that a manager must engage in order to create more life for himself, for herself, more life for every single person he comes into contact with. More life for the customers, the suppliers, the lenders, and the people that he or she enrolls into his cause. The people working with you in your business to produce these stunning things that I call transformative. I'm simply saying how we do business today is unacceptable. And you cannot get to a new world by simply altering the things we do incrementally. You have to transform them. And let's engage in the business of building a business that truly works. This seminar, this meeting, is really intended for all managers, small business managers, big business managers, not-for-profit managers, church managers, civil service managers, home office managers, no office managers, anyone who effectively has to manage anything, excluding yourself. This is not about self-management, because effectively, as I said earlier on, I don't believe people manage people. I believe that people manage process. You'll understand why, as we begin to go through this process, exactly what I mean by that, as we go through the seven steps of a manager's attention. So there are two words I'd like you to write down now, and one is intention, and the other is attention. Intention which is what we're here to do. Attention is our focus as we do it. So we used to have a poster at the Emyth Academy, which was called Focus on Results, Not on Work. And that was a great poster because it absolutely engaged people in understanding what they really need to focus their attention and intention on. Focus on results, not on work. Very difficult thing to get people to do. The second poster we published, essentially it said, focus on work, not on results. So the first poster said, focus on results, not on work. That was a blue poster. And the red poster said, focus on work, not on results. The first is intention. The second is attention. The balance between the two creates a living moment. And when I say a living moment, when one finds oneself connected to the end and the present, one begins to suddenly understand what true consciousness is all about. And there's an electricity in that moment. And I called or labeled that electricity the PowerPoint. And that was the subject of my second book, the PowerPoint. So I want you to just imagine the connection between the vision and the reality and being able to live within both simultaneously and the amount of energy that suddenly coalesces into a force that is truly undeniable. And that force, that undeniable force, is not an abstraction. It's what the martial artist experiences on the mat. And to the degree the martial artist doesn't experience it on the mat, the martial artist is doomed to be destroyed on the mat. It is distraction. It's what every extraordinary athlete experiences. It's that focus on results, focus on the work, and I'm in between those two, and those two are connected in me. And it's almost as though you can experience the grounding of that, which essentially connects me with everything I'm here to do, which is everything I'm here to create, while in the moment I'm creating it. It's a very, very, very important thing. And so it's important when I say that to you, that you understand that, in fact, the manager's role is also to focus on results while focusing on work simultaneously. So it's my contention, after years of very successful and not so successful management, and I've swung between those two over the years and worked with many, many, many thousands of managers through the initiative we call eMyth Mastery that we've been delivering for years to thousands upon thousands of clients, that management has less to do with what you do or what you manage than who you are. So effectively, a truly extraordinary manager is more determined to discover who he or she is, asking that question, who am I, who am I, who am I, than focusing on work. So when I said earlier this morning that the work of a manager is more inside work than it is outside work, I mean that. To the degree we're not continually doing the inside work, there is nothing to contribute on the outside. And so we become outer-directed people as opposed to inner-directed people. And we find ourselves in the outer rather than the inner. So we don't discover ourselves, we essentially manufacture ourselves as a mirror of expectations from the outside.